ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors at the ETF store and sponsored by iShares. iShares sponsorship is not an endorsement nor a recommendation for any product or service. iShares is not affiliated with the ETF store, ETF.com, or any of its affiliates. The ETF store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF store product or service. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. All investing involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. The ETF store owns and is responsible for all program content. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate will help you get up to date with what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
All right, great show this week. As always, I want to thank iShares, the exclusive sponsor of ETF Prime. One of the biggest stories in ETFs this year has been the record number of closures. You may have seen last week, the Wall Street Journal had a fairly prominent piece titled, "The Shakeout in the ETF Industry is Accelerating." And they noted how there have been more ETF closures than launches this year. In just a moment, I'll be joined by Heather Bell, who's managing editor for ETF.com, along with the ETF report. She follows ETF launches and closures probably as closely as anyone in the industry. We're going to discuss what's behind the spike in closures this year and whether this is anything concerning for the industry and also whether investors should be concerned. And then we'll also look at the other side of the equation as well, ETF launches. I actually want to have a little fun here. There have been several recent launches that have caught my attention for one reason or another. I'm going to throw these rapid fire at Heather to get her take. I have some good ones if you haven't stayed on top of these. And then speaking of ETF launches, one of the biggest names to enter ETFs this year has been Allianz Investment Management. Back in June, they launched their first ETFs. These are buffered outcome ETFs. I'll be joined by Johan Grahn, who's vice president of Allianz Investment Management. We'll talk about their decision to get involved here. Also have Johan explain how their buffered ETFs are structured and how they think about competition in this space, because this is quickly becoming a very popular segment of the ETF market. And I'm also curious as to whether Johan thinks these ETFs actually compete with Allianz's own insurance business. Allianz is a huge player in the annuity space, and it's been said buffer ETFs are a potential disruptor here. So we'll discuss that as well. And then also on the show this week will be Sal Bruno, Chief Investment Officer at IndexIQ, who's probably best known for their alternative ETFs. And Sal's been involved in the financial markets and portfolio management for some 25 years. So we're going to discuss how he's reading the current market environment and why he thinks investors should consider alternatives right now. As always, questions or comments, you can find me on Twitter at Nate Geraci, or you can go to etfprime.com. Also, one quick note, this Thursday, September 3rd, I'll be doing a live stream event with O'Shares Kevin O'Leary, Mr. Wonderful from Shark Tank. This is going to be a lot of fun. Now, this isn't part of ETF Prime. O'Shares will be hosting this, but I'd love to have you join us. So I tweeted out the link to register yesterday. It's free. I'll tweet it out again tomorrow, but we're going to cover a number of ETF topics and maybe even a little sports and politics as well. So join us if you can. Again, that's this Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern. Let's chat with ETF.com's Heather Bell.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
I ran the numbers again for the cheapest ESG ETF portfolio. These are good numbers. They're not marijuana good, but they're pretty good. If you believe that it's going to save you in the apocalypse, you might want to consider something else.
Heather, it is a pleasure finally having you on the podcast. Thank you for joining me.
Hi, Nate. It's really good to be on it. This is actually my first podcast.
ever.
Well, we're going to make this a wonderful experience for you. And I have to ask, I noted that you cover ETF launches and closures as closely as anyone. You publish the daily ETF watch for ETF.com that tracks all of this activity. On a scale from 1 to 10, how busy have you been this year? Like, are you constantly just combing through press releases and SEC filings?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this year has been crazy, mainly because of coronavirus. That really seems to be driving what's going on. The closures are probably going to hit a new record. We're currently at the Wall Street Journal article was slightly off in that some of the closures that they were reporting haven't happened yet. So we're currently at about 181 completed closures for the year, with two more scheduled, and then five Goldman Sachs ETFs are going to combine into one. The Mosaic ETFs they're set to kind of merge into one innovation focused product. So it's not exactly a closure. It's almost like a restructuring or consolidation, I guess you would call it.
So what do you make of the situation overall? So we mentioned the Wall Street Journal piece. I feel like just about every financial media outlet has run some version of this story. And from my perspective, this seems mostly a result of the market environment, right? Especially this year, back in March, when we saw a bunch of leverage and inverse products close because of basically math, because of volatility. However, the other narrative is that maybe the ETF space has become a bit oversaturated. Maybe there are too many gimmicky launches. So I'm just curious, as someone who follows this as closely as you do, what do you make of the situation overall in terms of closures?
I actually think that we're not going to know if we've hit the saturation point until a year or two after it's happened, because ETF trends with launches and closures tend to be kind of choppy. There's not really a lot of like steady growth in one direction or another. I mean, if you look at the most recent years, 2019 had total launch of 255. 2018, it was 269. And 2017, it was 2071. And that's kind of like a deceleration, you know, by about like by 3 1 year, and then by maybe 14 the next year. That's not really enough to establish a trend if it continues with launches slowing down. It's going to be, then it will establish a trend. But I also think that with all the closures this year, it kind of cleared the field, I think, for a lot of firms to, you know, just kind of roll in with pandemic-inspired ETFs. And you previously mentioned defined outcome ETFs, and so those are launching, like some of those are launching every month. Still, I mean, Innovator has their first initial suite of S&P 500 buffer ETFs, but they're continuing in other directions. So you've got, I think, currently four participants launching ETFs on a monthly basis that are kind of guaranteed to launch. So it's almost like there's a boost, an automatic boost this year of how many funds are going to launch just based on the defined outcome ETFs and issuers trying to complete their suites.
Yeah, and I do think ETF launches have picked up here more recently. I expect that to be the case as we move on throughout the remainder of the year. I think earlier, some issuers may have been hesitant to launch new ETFs just because of the environment, right? We know, like, yes, on the quote-unquote non-transparent ETFs, those were delayed because of the market environment. I think there are a number of examples of that. On the closure side, I do think that a number of issuers have just taken the market environment as an opportunity to really prune product lineups. And I kind of equate this a little bit to the Friday afternoon news dump, right, where you can kind of close up some products. Maybe it goes under the radar. Nobody notices just because of the other products being closed. I saw actually just on Friday, Direction announced the pending closure of like 15 ETFs. But we've also seen, I know with Invesco, they closed a bunch of ETFs following the acquisitions of Oppenheimer and Guggenheim ETFs, right? So that's out there. Now, all that said, one thing I always like to mention in discussing this topic, I think it's important to remember that if we think the ETF marketplace is oversaturated, there are something like 8,000 mutual funds, right? we just need to keep some context here. Okay, Heather, so on the topic of launches, I thought it might be fun just to get your quick take on some new ETFs that have caught my attention for one reason or another. All of these have launched since early July. So what I'll do is I'll just throw these out, and then you can tell me whatever comes to mind. And I want to start with what's actually been one of the most successful launches this year, even though it only debuted on July 29th, so like a month ago, the Global X Telemedicine and Digital Health ETF, ticker EDOC, EDOC. So this already has over $300 million invested in it, which, by the way, I keep saying Global X is turning into a machine. It's amazing when you look at this ETF. And you look at their cloud computing ETF and robotics ETF. I saw their lithium and battery tech ETF. That's done really well this year. It's amazing how much success they're having. But any thoughts on EDOC?
I actually think, I know that the pandemic was probably the spark for it, but I feel like that's the reason that probably has so much money is because that's kind of where healthcare has been heading, maybe. I feel like there's a tendency towards more automation, more connectivity, more convenience in areas like healthcare and kind of, you know, minimizing contact in a way. And so there's probably a lot of people interested because of the pandemic, but I feel like there was probably already a market for this ETF even before it was put into registration.
Yeah, no question, but you're right. The timing was perfect when you think about what's going on with telemedicine, right? And everything moving more towards digitization. I think that's why this is finding an audience. But also, again, that Global X machine, just their ability to get their products out in front of investors is pretty remarkable. Okay, another ETF that popped on my radar was the Inspire Tactical Balanced ESG ETF. The ticker on this is RISN, RISN, which you have to love that ticker. But this launched on July 15th, already has nearly $70 million in assets. And I think like Global X, it's noteworthy that Inspire ETFs is sort of quietly scaling up. They have six ETFs, nearly $600 million altogether. I think that may surprise some people. But what do you think is going on here in terms of the early success of RISN?
There's been religiously kind of based ETFs. There were the faith shares that didn't really last that long. There's been several Islamic-focused ETFs. But I think with the Inspire products, they're definitely tailored for the evangelical community. And there was a lot of latent demand there because this isn't like – this is specifically, I feel like, targeted at evangelicals, which are not necessarily a denomination like the faith shares we're targeting. There's also a Catholic ETF out there. But it's more ESG-focused than a lot of their other products. So it kind of combines religious values with ESG values. So I think that was just another kind of fund with a lot of latent demand just waiting to happen. The evangelical community is pretty large in this country.
By the way, I was going to say, you have to love the tickers on their other ETFs. I don't know if you've looked through all these. I mean, they have BLESS, BLES. They have BIBL, Bible. They have the WWJD, the What Would Jesus Do? You got to give them credit on the ticker side.
Oh, yeah. Their ticker game is strong. they're very witty, and those tickers do promote ETF. Like, a good ticker can really help a fund, especially if there's already demand for it. A good ticker is not going to save every fund, but for something like this, it can only help it.
Okay, I want to throw a couple of other recent launches at you, one of which actually has a pretty good ticker, Dual, D-U-A-L. This is the North Shore Dual Share Class ETF. This launched August 11th. The question I have for you on this one is, do you think there's an audience for this? Because this did strike me as a unique launch, wasn't one I had really thought of. Do you think there's going to be a large enough audience for this strategy?
I am curious about that, too, just because it's kind of an obscure investment argument compared to others. What we're seeing is a lot of money go into established cap-based plain vanilla ETFs. That's been the trend for years. So I think there's an uphill battle in bringing this message to investors, but it's not really a perspective I've ever considered before. I was like, oh, I'd never thought of that when I saw the ETF launch. And so maybe it's a good investment argument. Once it has a few years of performance, that could make all the difference. But I think initially they're going to have maybe a difficult time gathering assets for it, just because it's kind of not an argument that's at the an investment argument that's at the forefront of everyone's mind.
No, I would agree with that. And we should point out, I mean, really the investment case here is that the dual share class structure may be able to result in better returns. And the thought is if you have one share class of a company that's held by executives and founders, that really allows them to focus more on long-term goals instead of really short-term shareholder considerations or expectations. And so I just think this will be interesting. I mean, there's some pretty prominent companies that have this dual share class structure. I think this is one where I think it's a really unique concept. It'll obviously come down to performance.
Yeah, that will probably be the determining factor for it.
Okay.
But again, a really good ticker.
Yeah, no doubt. Okay, one more launch. This probably falls in the category of COVID-inspired ETFs. Just last week, we saw Direction launch the Connected Consumer ETF, ticker CCON. And this looked to me like sort of the leisure version of their work-from-home ETF that they launched earlier this year, which that's done really well in terms of assets, already over $100 million. But what did you think of this ETF, CCON?
Well, I think this is capturing a trend that was already going on, and COVID accelerated it. But the one thing I will note, though, is I think you're really correct in kind of describing it as like the leisure version of WFH. But the thing about it is that I found interesting is these are funds with only 40 components, but they have an overlap of 6 components when I was looking at the different holdings. So like there's 6 stocks that are shared between the two of them. And my concern about it is if someone's like investing in, you know, those two as two sides of one coin, I guess you could say, and then they've got their regular portfolio, they may be a little overexposed to stuff like Amazon, which is in both funds, or I can't remember some of the other ones. I think like 8x8, which is actually a very tiny company, is in both funds.
Well, there's clearly been an audience for the work-from-home ETF, and I just pulled up the fact sheet on the CCON. So this covers 4 areas of the digital economy: home entertainment, online education, remote health, and then virtual/digital social interaction. And it basically holds 10 companies in each of those 4 categories. So, you know, look, if you think about those individual segments, we talked about EDOC earlier with the remote health. I mean, I think there's something to it if we think the pandemic is accelerating trends into these different, you know, subsectors. So I'll be interested to see if it can find the same success as WFH. Okay, a few minutes left. As I look at the most successful ETF launches overall this year, as it turns out, they're both from iShares. So the iShares 0-3 month Treasury Bond ETF, ticker SGOV, S-G-O-V, that launched at the end of May, already well over $800 million in assets. And then the other one is the iShares ESG MSCI EM Leaders ETF, ticker LDEM. That launched in February, already has nearly $700 million. Any quick thoughts on why these two ETFs have shown some success?
Well, if you go into willwisdom.com, they show that the latest, I think there's 13F filings. Boston Private Wealth, which is an advisory firm, from what I understand, they're the bulk of the assets. I think they have something like 600 or 700 million invested in ESGOV. And then Ilmarinen, the Finnish pension insurer that was kind of behind SUSL, I'm sorry, SUSL and USSG, they have about 570 million in LVEM as of the last 13F filing. So it's kind of like they've almost, I'm wondering if there was some sort of like deal or something like that where iShares launch these funds with the understanding that these firms would be investing in them or that they would support the launches. Because that's a lot of money from one entity to go into a new ETF. So I guess it's a bring your own assets situation.
Yeah, and I guess the hope there, and we've talked a lot about this in the ESG space, that if you have that those assets in the funds, perhaps it'll attract other retail-oriented assets. And I think that's what everybody's looking for in the ESG space is what happens. Because I think if you look across a lot of the most successful ESG ETFs so far, a lot of them do appear to be a situation where it's a bring-your-own-assets or you've had a couple of really lead investors see those products. So can we see organic growth there? I definitely think with ESGOV, we're going to see organic growth there. I mean, that's a pretty plain vanilla product that I think will have a use case in some portfolios. Yeah. Obviously, the ESG we've talked a lot about on the podcast. We'll see what happens there. But Heather, we'll have to leave it there. Again, really glad to finally connect and have you on the podcast. Excellent job this week. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me on. It was a lot of fun.
That was ETF.com's Heather Bell. My next guest is Johan Grahn, Vice President of Allianz Investment Management, who back in June, they launched their first ETFs. These are buffered outcome ETFs. They currently have four ETFs in all, and Johan is now on the line with me from Minneapolis. Johan, congratulations on the new launches, and thank you for joining me.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's my pleasure, Nate.
Okay, so let's start with who Allianz Investment Management is, because I think many people are probably familiar with Allianz Life Insurance, and then certainly the PIMCO brand, which is actually under the Allianz SE umbrella. What's the distinction here?
Yeah, sure. No, we all roll up into the broader Allianz organization. So PIMCO, most of your listeners know of PIMCO, I'm sure, one of the premier bond managers. We also have a firm, Allianz Global Investors. So they focus on active management across, you know, several different asset classes. But we're all three separate entities. So I represent Allianz Investment Management, and we're wholly owned by the U.S.-based Allianz Life here out of Minneapolis. And as you mentioned, you know, we recently launched our first ETF. They're out now on the New York Stock Exchange and trading. But what most people probably don't know is that we manage, as an organization here, derivatives, which includes, by the way, a huge book of options strategies. That's all managed out of our trade desk here in Minneapolis for affiliates actually around the world to the tune of $150 billion. So it's a pretty significant business that we have here. And, of course, the notional amount that we're trading on this platform is, you know, several multiples of that every year. So I guess the key here is that this is all done in-house on our proprietary systems, and we've been actively managing risk for decades and built and expanded our capital markets capabilities along with the growth of the organization over time. So risk management and options trading is really a core part of what we do for the broader organization. It's part of our DNA. So effectively, we're probably one of the largest risk managers in the world that most people have never heard of.
Okay, so these four buffer outcome ETFs that you've launched so far under the Allianz IM brand, I guess first, why enter the ETF space with these particular products? And then I'm curious, why now?
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, good question. I think the core of our business, since it's been around risk management, it's a very natural evolution for us. It's really, we have on the annuity side of the business, we've been managing, whether it's option-based portfolios or otherwise, portfolios with caps and buffers for a very long time, and risk management is really what's been close to our heart. So while we've been helping, you know, millions of people with retirement and to help them retire with confidence, there are obviously millions of other people that we have not been able to reach, which, you know, an annuity might not be the best fit. Nevertheless, there is this need, age-old need, I would say, for risk management and confidence building into portfolios, whether it's for pre-retirement or into retirement, or even, frankly, for anyone that's risk-averse in nature. That need's always been there. So for us to move into the ETF space with something that's close to our core and core value proposition makes a lot of sense. So that's a pretty straightforward one. I guess the timing in terms of why now, for one, I mean, this is now enabled through trading strategies that previously had not been accessible and then changes in the ETF landscape overall. I think one thing in terms of another thing in terms of timing, I guess, is that you can look at this and say, well, you know, we have a lot of volatility. We have elections coming up. We have a pandemic going on. There's a lot of anxiety. VIX has been quite sporadic over the last several months and so on and so forth. I actually think that's less ideal to come out with this buffered ETF product because we're not launching this based on the current environment. We're launching this and we've launched this because we think there is a long-term value proposition for these type of solutions. So it's a bit of a double-edged sword. It's good and it's not so good. The expectation, though, is not that this is a short-term solution to short-term problems. This is a much bigger value proposition.
Okay, so for listeners who are unfamiliar with the buffered outcome approach, I thought what we might do is look specifically at your two most recent launches. So the Allianz IM U.S. Large Cap Buffer 10 July ETF, ticker AZAL, and the Allianz IM U.S. Large Cap Buffer 20 July ETF, ticker AZBL. Obviously, AZAL, that has a 10% downside buffer, and AZBL has a 20% buffer. Walk us through how these ETFs are put together, just at a basic level.
Yeah, so if we take a quick look under the hood, and then I'll turn over to the, I can talk about more how this strategy actually works from a practical standpoint. Under the hood, we're trading what's called flex options. And all that means is that these are options that are customizable in such a way that we can create the exact payoff for these ETFs that we're looking for in terms of time and strike prices and so on and so forth. They're also trading on an exchange, which makes them very liquid, and they also don't carry any credit risk. So that's the instrument that we're using. And these are flex options on the S&P 500 price return index. And the way we build these portfolios, once we get the long exposure to the S&P 500, the buffer is typically established by buying a put at the money and you sell a put at the buffer level, so either 10% or 20% out of the money. So since the put that we're buying at the money is more expensive than the put that we're selling at the 10 or 20% level, we need to finance this extra cost. And that's basically done by selling a call, and this effectively sets the cap on the portfolio and creates the buffer cap profile. So it's a classic, you know, downside risk mitigation versus upside potential trade-off. And while there's an endless number of ways that this can be done, we've decided to keep it simple with our 10 and 20 buffers. And I guess I should point out, too, that even if these are derivatives and options in this case, this is not a levered ETF. There's no leverage on the ETF itself. And I guess the very practically speaking, when you're investing in these ETFs, at the end of the day, we're providing equity market exposure, in this case to the S&P 500. up to a cap, and then we are protecting on the downside by buffering against a certain amount of losses. So it's really straightforward in that sense. So if I use our 20% buffer just as an example, it will let you participate in positive returns up to this cap. So let's say for the sake of argument that the cap is 8%. So in return for that cap on the upside, you get a 20% buffer on the downside. So if the market drops by 20% or less over a outcome period of 1 year, the ETF does not lose money. But if the S&P 500 is down 22%, you would lose 2%. On the other hand, if the market's up by 8% or less, you get the full 8%. And if the market is up more than 8%, you get the 8%. So from that standpoint, it's really quite simple, and therein lies part of the beauty of this type of product.
Johan, anytime we talk buffered outcome ETFs on this podcast, I always like to ask about the investor education component to these. And I agree, the way that you just explain everything, it is very simple, it is very straightforward. But the way I'll frame my question is, these products are ultimately point-to-point investments, right? In order to get what's on the label, that upside cap and downside buffer, you have to invest on day one and then hold these throughout the entire outcome period. Do you have any concerns that investors may not understand that? And then I guess, if so, how are you going about educating the marketplace on that?
You know, I think you're hitting the nail on the head here. This is a very important topic. If you get this wrong up front when you're working with your, whether you're an advisor working with a client, or if you're an issuer working with advisors or wherever you talk about this, if you get this wrong up front, you're going to have issues down the road. So I'm glad you're asking about this. Even if you get it right up front, people's perceptions and their memories, they tend to change over time, and especially when things get wacky in the market. So there's also a need for, you know, continuous education. I think this is true for any investment, and expectation setting that you can really make or break a relationship. So I think the beauty, again, of these ETFs is that the high-level concept is quite simple. It's pretty simple to grasp, you know, a buffer and a cap concept. When you buy in, you know what your max gain is going to be, and you know what your level of downside risk mitigation is going to be, and you know what the outcome period is. If you can know those three things, you're in pretty good shape. Now, what you're referring to, I think, is the period in between the start and the end of this outcome period. And when you think about that, as they call it, the intra period, the questions are, you can make it complicated if you want to, but you can also make it very simple and straightforward. And as you're thinking about this, questions that come to mind is, well, if I buy today, what's the remaining cap? What's the remaining buffer? How much can I lose before the buffer kicks in? Those are all, you know, standard questions that come in and should be asked, frankly, if you're buying intra period. And for this, we have a tool on our website. It's at allianzim.com. We'll always provide this information. It's updated throughout the day, so you'll always know exactly what those parameters are when you're buying into the ETF. So that's the first pit stop to solve for this. It's our website. You always know what you're looking to buy and what those parameters are. But we've also, you know, in recognizing this need for education, and it's critical. We developed a short, you know, few minutes of an explainer video. We will be providing webinars with, you know, market commentary and educational components. We are looking to also make all these materials available, whether they are investor guides, so on and so forth, because we know this is important. So this is a place where we're going to focus for sure. I think one thing that I would point out too, if you don't mind, we also have a strategic partnership with a firm called Halo. So for those of your listeners who are familiar with Halo, great to ask them about this. And for those that don't, you may want to check it out. It's a firm that basically provides a tech solution to all these questions. It actually allows advisors to look at buffer ETF holdings by clients, so you can set up notifications for when an ETF is approaching an outcome period. or if you're reaching a cap or a buff level and so on and so forth. Platform, you know, it also solves for some of the what-if scenarios. If you're buying today, what if the market goes up? What if you have a bear? You know, what can you expect both graphically and numerically? You get the information at the fingertips. So that's a really, really slick solution for educational components and expectation setting as well. So I guess we're recognize this, and we're doing a lot to help with the education. And I guess I'll leave it at that.
Well, and I think something else that's helping here, even though maybe from your standpoint, you don't necessarily want to see a lot of competition, this space is becoming a very popular category, I think, quickly with investors. And so as we have more competitors in the space, the good of that is I think there's more education out there. And as these products are out in the mainstream and in the media, that will help in the overall efforts to allow investors to really grasp how these products work. I guess on that note, how do you view the competitive landscape? Because I guess on the surface, just at a very basic level, these products all look pretty similar across the different issuers that have launched buffered outcome ETF so far. How do you differentiate and find success?
Yeah, sure. No, it's healthy competition is good as a general statement, and I would say that it's really a market now that's in its infancy still. It's emerging quickly, but let's face it, most advisors and investors, they've never heard of buffer ETFs. Very thankful for the job and the opportunity to talk about this today, because I think it's a solution that more people should know about. We're just at the start, basically, of the climb up the adaptation curve. So it's very exciting for that reason. There's plenty of space to move. Now, in terms of competition, you know, these strategies, they may look easy enough to replicate, and you can put marketing behind this, and of course, you know, you can look at the growth trajectory and get excited about what the opportunity might look like. I would say, though, as an investor, you really want to make sure that you have stability behind the execution, behind the scenes. And I think we're well positioned to deliver very confidently on this. We bring a long track record and a long history of risk management. Like I mentioned before, it's basically in the core of our DNA as a firm. And so we don't outsource the management of the ETF itself. It's all done in-house. The portfolio management, the trading desk is, like as I mentioned, here in Minneapolis. So with this, we gain some efficiencies, and we also have the lowest ETF buffer ETF fee right now at 74 basis points. And with this, it's while we're newer to the marketplace now, and we also have great relationships with our lead market maker, and they've been able to provide really good market quality. Keeping our bid-ask spreads within a dime, so very competitive. And when you couple the low fees with the tight bid-ask, you have a very attractively traded ETF, and there is something to be said for that as well.
Johan, on this topic of competition, what about this idea that you're simply competing with yourself? Because one of the primary selling points I've heard for buffered ETFs is they offer something pretty similar to what you could get with an annuity, except you have the added benefits of daily liquidity and lower fees and no surrender charges, and I guess also without the credit risk you might have with some insurance products. Are you now competing with yourself at all?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, let me start by saying then that product selection, investing decisions, they're rarely straightforward, and they're definitely binary in nature. So There's always a different solution that fits a different investor at different times throughout their life. So there's plenty of room for for all of us. And sometimes an annuity is a great fit, sometimes it's not. And sometimes a buffer ETF is a great fit, and sometimes it's not. It's kind of that simple. But for all the trade-offs, you know, and the decisions that need to be made, and keep in mind that they're based on each individual's needs and investor profiles, and this is really what makes an advisor's job, you know, kind of tricky here, because there's rarely a quote-unquote 100% right answer. So the decision point, I mean, they should really be around different forms of risk management, not binary, you know, annuity versus buffer ETF. That's not how it works. But in terms of risk management strategies, whatever they might be, they could be structured notes, they could be hedge funds, they could be volatility managed solutions, risk parity, smart beta. I mean, the list goes on, right? Tactical asset allocation and so on and so forth. So there's a lot to weigh here. But the short answer is no. We don't see the ETF as a competing product to our existing business. For us, it's really another solution for advisors and their clients to use in their pursuit of confident risk management.
Okay, before I let you go, just looking forward, I know you can't talk specific business strategy and potential ETF launches you might be contemplating, but can you give us some sense as to what the future might hold for Allianz ETFs? I'm assuming you're going to continue expanding the buffer suite, but what else can we expect?
Well, it's a starting point for us, right? It's a new market. We're clearly getting into this to stay here for the long term. We pride ourselves too on our long market of product innovation. So you can expect some of that coming down the pike. That's a skill set that we have learned and developed over many decades, you know, on the annuity side. And with that, you learn a few lessons along the way. And for us, what it means that basically we're not in the business of just, you know, throwing products against the wall to see what sticks. We're much more methodical. We want to listen to our partners, to financial advisors and investors alike. And we seek to meet the demand where it is. And so while it might take a little bit longer for some products to show up, when they do, they show up with confidence and we're in it for the long run. So also when it comes to risk management, and again, this is the age-old problem, right? What can we do here, and how do we best help people, whether it's retire with confidence or invest, you know, in the accumulation phase with confidence? Well, we've had ample time to refine and optimize our strategies for a long time, since this has always been our focus as a firm. So the trading platform and everything we've done is set up to deliver on these type of structures. The ETF space is obviously new to us, but this is how we have worked and how we plan to continue to work going forward. So effectively, we just packaged our expertise now for the first time. And we've delivered it into the ETF wrapper so that more people can get access to what we think is a pretty elegant risk management solution. And with this, we would also say, and I'll finish my thought here, but it makes sense for investors that are looking at buffer ETFs to contemplate investing with a company that is a risk management shop first, one that has deep knowledge in options trading and a firm that belongs to one of the largest global insurance and asset management companies in the world, frankly. We think it makes a lot of sense, and we're excited about the future of defined outcome ETFs.
Well, Johan, really enjoyed the conversation this week. Again, congratulations on the entrance into ETFs. I certainly wish you all the success. Thank you for joining me.
Yeah, no, totally my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Johan Grahn, Vice President of Allianz Investment Management. I'm now joined by Sal Bruno, Chief Investment Officer at Index IQ, which is part of New York Life Investments. They currently offer 20 ETFs, about $3.3 billion invested, including several alternative ETFs, led by their flagship IQ Hedge Multi-Strategy Tracker ETF, ticker symbol QAI. Sal is on the line with me from New York. Sal, always great having you on the show.
Nate, it's great to speak with you.
Okay, so I want to start with the financial markets because you've been involved in portfolio management for some 25 years now. You've obviously seen a lot of ups and downs. And if we go back to earlier this year, the S&P 500 dropped nearly 35%. We saw credit markets freeze up. I feel like it was truly a panic-type environment. And then you fast forward to today, here we are, stocks at record highs. There's apparently plenty of liquidity in the credit markets. And all of this happened in the span of 5-6 months. I'm curious, what was your take on everything back in March? And then how are you feeling about things right now?
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, you talk about what a change of events we've seen over the past, 5 to 6 months. You know, back in March, it really was fear, I'd say bordering on panic. And you just saw credit market seize. You saw strategies that normally work fairly well when the markets go down. But, you had this general fear that was in a panic situation going on. And nobody really knew what was going on with this virus, what it would take for it to try and get the virus under control, and what the implications would be of a shutdown on the economy and the markets. And so that fear really kept going until around the third week of March when the Fed stepped in and really provided a lot of liquidity and provided liquidity, and they said they would start buying bonds and bond ETFs. Eventually they got around to that. And so that really put a floor under the fixed income markets and helped to ease some of the credit tensions we had seen there and the liquidity issues. And the same was true on the equity markets. You also factor in the fact that we had, a tremendous amount of government stimulus, expanded unemployment benefits that went further in terms of the amount of money, that went further in terms of the time period that people would be covered. And so you started to put a lot of money back into the economy, not just the capital markets, but back into the economy. And I think that really did a great job of providing confidence to at least the capital markets that things would actually be okay. And remember, capital markets tend to be forward-looking discounting mechanisms. And so they were trying to look past the shutdown to see what the economy would look like post-shutdown, trying to anticipate would there be a V-shaped recovery or K or whatever, and there's so many different letters out there. And ultimately we saw kind of a V-shaped recovery in certain segments of the market. So manufacturing has done really well. We just had a report come out this morning that continues strong manufacturing numbers, strong real estate numbers. Very good labor, after taking an initial hit, we started to see recovery. It hasn't fully recovered, but we've started to see the initial claims come down pretty sharply. The consumer is still kind of on a weak basis, and I think a lot of municipalities are going to have some issues going forward. So right now, we've had some very strong capital markets, some recovery in the economy, but I think people are nervous. We have upcoming elections. We have the end of the government stimulus and nothing really in its place. We also have back to school, and we've seen the effect on college campuses of is this the second wave of the coronavirus coming. So, we've seen some really strong performance, but right now I think people are getting a little nervous again.
Sal, when you talk about a potential recovery in the economy, and you mentioned the manufacturing numbers, I do think a lot of the discussion right now centers on, I'll say, reconciling the stock market with the economic data. And I keep saying the same thing. We all know the stock market isn't the economy, right? I get all that. Yep. But I also don't think you can just ignore what's happening when you look at things like unemployment. And I do think there's some real devastation across small businesses in particular. I think we're seeing some cracks in certainly commercial real estate, residential real estate's on fire. But
yeah.
Does this matter? Like, does the economy and stocks need to reconcile at some point? Or do you feel like the Fed and government stimulus just completely distorts everything here? Just how do you view those two, sort of divergent areas?
Yeah, so I think, government stimulus and Fed money, I think, has papered over or helped to cover up some of the underlying weaknesses that you've described very accurately. And when you look at the stock market, it's really interesting. You have to look kind of at what's leading the market, and it's really been led by what I call consumer tech. Now, that's not technically a sector, according to the GICS definition. There's consumer, there's technology, but I think there actually should be a sector called consumer tech. Things like Amazon, Facebook, Microsoft, Apple. Amazon by itself has been more than 100% of the contribution of total return of the S&P 500 since it hit its previous high on February 19th. So from February 19th to the end of the month, which you just said yesterday, more than 100% of the return of the market has actually come from one name. That would be Amazon. So when you say the market is doing well, that's great, but it's really three or four names that are driving it. The average stock in the S&P is actually down about 6% over that time period, despite the fact that the S&P is up a couple of percent. More than half the names are actually still in negative territory. So, you know, when we look at what is the market, you know, it can be a little bit distorted by concentration in these consumer tech names.
Does that give you any concern when you look at the FANG stocks and we look at something like Tesla that's up, what, 490, 500% year to date? You look at Zoom spiking this morning. When you see those types of names moving the way they are and just adding billions in market cap, does that cause you any concern?
It doesn't, to the extent that much of the rest of these stocks are being left behind. If we were to see a whole bunch of stocks kind of going up, we had greater breadth, that would give us a little bit more confidence. But when you have kind of these one-offs, that's great if you own them, but it's you know, really kind of like trying to shoot an arrow and hitting a particular stock. And, you know, we know individual stocks can be very risky. When you get a diversified basket, that tends to be a much safer, more consistent type return pattern. But we're not seeing that right now. So, yes, that does give us cause for concern on a going forward basis, especially when you look at the overall, you know, future expected return. So for the equity market, it's trading at a forward PE of 27, which is very high historically, with only a 1.6% yield. It's priced, basically every metric is elevated, whether it be price to book, price to sales, price to cash flow. And so the forward-looking expected returns for equity, so any individual stock could be terrific potentially. You know, there's nothing to say Tesla can't go up even more from here. But I think overall as a market, we have to be a little bit concerned about the valuation that's in place and what that means for forward returns on the equity market. Fixed income market, you know, equally so. On the treasuries, you have the 10-year treasury yielding 72 basis points. And so with the Fed committed to keeping rates at zero, but not trying to let them go below zero, there's really very limited scale for fixed income returns on a going forward basis at, you know, 72 basis points of yield on the 10-year. And probably not a whole lot of price appreciation. The yields can't go down that much more from here. So I think on a forward-looking basis, we have to question the expected returns for both equities and fixed income.
Okay, so with that in mind, because I think you raised some good points, especially on the fixed income side, from a portfolio management perspective, and let's just assume a traditional 60-40 investor. I think that's always a good frame of reference for most people. What do you think are some key factors those types of investors should be considering right now, given what we're seeing in both stocks and bonds?
Well, I think it's really key to manage your risk and to look for additional sources of returns, uncorrelated sources of returns. So, for example, in fixed income, people still need yield, and they're getting very little from their basically their treasuries or their bank accounts, and so they've been bidding up high-yield bonds. And so if you look at spreads on those have come in dramatically, despite the fact that if you look at defaults, those are actually rising pretty rapidly. And so what we would recommend is for people who want to just continue to get income but are a little bit concerned about the risk they're taking to do it is potentially segment the high-yield marketplace and own the least risky bonds. So we have an ETF, HYLV, High Yield Low Volatility. It takes the 50% least risky bonds each month, and that least risk is defined by things like spread and duration, typical things that people look at for risk for bonds, and tries to own those. Now, you're not getting quite as much yield as the overall market, the overall high-yield market, but you're still getting a very competitive yield, but potentially cutting some of that downside risk should some more of those defaults start to magnify. And so we think that, you know, a smarter way to try to get core exposure is one way to try to navigate these particular times. Also, alternative strategies can be really helpful in this time period. And we have a whole suite of liquid alternatives. Many of them are based on the concept of hedge fund replication. So what we're trying to do is to look at different and well-known hedge fund strategies, things like long, short, event-driven, market-neutral strategies, and not actually owning individual hedge funds or even their individual positions, but just trying to identify what are the key factors that are driving those returns. For long, short, it's definitely been growth versus value, you know, large cap versus small cap, things like that. And we invest in other ETFs to get those exposures. But those have actually proven themselves to really dampen over this time period that we've seen, really help dampen some of the downside volatility that you've experienced in the equity markets, and then help participate in the upside. And one of the really interesting things is you talked about the S&P, you know, the markets being down 30, 35%. And what a lot of people don't realize is when something's down 35%, you need much more than 35% to recover. To get back to where you were, you actually need 50%. Now, we just kind of crossed over that threshold at the end of August, so now the S&P is back in slightly positive territory since the drawdown began. But if you look at strategies like our long short, QLS, or QED, which is our event-driven, because they went down so much less than the S&P during that time period, but they participated in the upside, they're actually pretty much right about where the S&P is, you know, peak to peak, but with significantly less volatility. So we think that those are really interesting strategies for potentially diversifying some of that downside risk in the portfolio while still maintaining some upside exposure.
And Sal, I think that makes a lot of sense when you talk about mitigating that downside risk. I think with alts, really the idea is to add diversification to a portfolio. They can have a lower correlation to the equity market. One question I would have is, let's say we get a scenario where stock returns are muted moving forward. We talked about where valuations are right now in some of these high-flying tech stocks. But let's say moving forward, things aren't quite as rosy. And then we already know where fixed income is at with how low yields are. And so our expectations for returns there moving forward, I think, have to be muted. How do alts typically react? And I'm using the term alts broadly, but how do alts typically react in that type of environment?
So there's a range of alts, and you acknowledge, you know, we're talking about a wide range of strategies. There on one end, there are, you know, things that are really trying to be very, very defensive, things that we call like sort of tail risk, hedging type strategies, all the way up to commodities, which one could consider alts as well, which tend to have a lot more upside in sort of late cycle type of an environment. You know, when we're looking at our strategies, they tend to be more in the 5-10% volatility range, so more like core hedge fund type strategies, things like long, short, event driven, QAI you mentioned, which is our largest and oldest ETF, which covers a whole, it covers six different hedge fund strategies. You know, those tend to dampen some of the volatility on the downside, but also try to participate on the upside. You know, one strategy which we haven't discussed yet is our merger arbitrage ETF, ticker is M&A, pretty easy to remember for mergers and acquisitions. And that particular strategy tends to have very low correlation to the S&P 500. Now, one of the things we saw in that particular strategy is during the fear that gripped the not only the economy but the markets in March, merger arbitrage strategies broadly across the board kind of sold off, because one of the great things about merger arbitrage strategies is that their risk tends to be very uncorrelated or very deal-specific. So each individual deal really has nothing to do with what's going on with the overall economy or the market. It tends to be, will this deal get completed or will it get rejected? And what happened, though, in March is the risk of deals getting highly correlated with each other. In other words, everybody was worried, because we were entering into these uncharted waters, that all deals would basically fall off. We didn't know which ones were going to complete or not. And so we started to see the deal premiums start to widen out, and that led to merger arbitrage strategies getting hit a little bit harder than, you know, many people had anticipated. Once we started to get sort of a thawing of that risk, we started to see the strategies come back sharply and pretty much recovered most of what they had lost over that time period. So in normal market sell-offs, the type of environment you're talking about, that's really not fear or panic related, but just more equity markets are elevated, we're worried about valuation, those types of sell-offs, a merger arbitrage strategy can actually do really well. We saw in the fourth quarter of 2018, when the equity markets were down, you know, was about 20%, 21%, merger arb strategies were basically flat to slightly positive for that fourth quarter of 2018. So in that type of environment, we think merger arb strategies can actually do really well.
Sal, just a couple minutes left. I know you and I have visited about this in the past, but I do feel like with alternatives, for a lot of investors, it just feels like a complicated space. It's not as straightforward as stocks and bonds, at least on the surface. Can you offer any tips for investors? Like, how can they get more comfortable here? Because when you talk about merger arbitrage and hedge fund replication, I know for some investors that comes across as complicated. Any tips on improving the level of comfortability here?
Well, I'd say first and foremost, visit our website, iqetfs.com, iqetfs.com. And that we have a whole host of resources on education. We are trying to be as transparent as possible, not only on our strategies, but also what liquid alts mean in general. And so, you know, we're very happy to have conversations. Myself or anybody on our team is very happy to have that conversation with anybody who wants to go a little bit deeper, wants to understand, you know, how the strategy works, but probably even more importantly, what it can do for your portfolio, how it is that we try to manage some of the downside volatility while still maintaining some of the upside exposure. We're happy to have those conversations. So definitely visit our website, reach out to us, and we can definitely set up those conversations.
Well, Sal, excellent perspective. Always appreciate the time. Thank you for joining me this week.
Thanks, Nate.
That was Sal Bruno, Chief Investment Officer at Index IQ. That'll do it for this week's ETF Prime. I want to thank our exclusive sponsor, iShares. You can visit iShares.com to learn more about their investment strategies. As always, you can find me out on Twitter at Nate Geraci, or you can send comments through ETFPrime.com. Next week, following Labor Day, I'll be replaying some of my favorite conversations from over the summer. It'll be a best of ETF Prime. Until then, have a great week, everyone.